around you. I think we probably all have those kind of contexts. I think we all have, in a sense, suffer. We feel that at different times. For simplicity's sake, let's say that you're in a room of 100 people. So not far from where we're at this morning, I guess. And there might be some particular reason why you're there, that you share a common interest with these people, but you don't know these people. You might have some experience or expertise in something that you share with these people, but you don't know these people. How does it feel in that particular room? Some of us have to do that kind of thing for work. Some of us experience it when we go to a new group for some reason. But how do you feel in that particular room? Psychology, I think we're programmed to think a number of different things, feel a number of different ways in that kind of context, that we're, I guess, programmed to think a number of different ways and conditioned to divide and associate along a number of different lines. There's the party principle, which usually says that at least at one point during the evening that the men and the women will completely divide, and that one of those groups will be found in the kitchen. I don't know why that's the party principle, and I'm not dividing along gender lines in that, but it's just that one group always finds itself in the kitchen, and you stand around talking. But inevitably, at some point during a party, the men and women will separate themselves. I don't know if you've ever found that, but I certainly have. There's the economical principle, the economic principle, where you find that business women, business men that work in similar or fields, or certainly the same kind of power of fields, that they, again, you tend to find that if you have a party of that sort, that people tend to associate along economic lines in that same kind of way. If that room of 100 people were a genuine reflection of modern society somehow, that in that room there were 80, in the UK certainly there'd be about 80 white people, that there would be somewhere in the region of about 7 what we might call British Asian, we might find 6 black people from different origins, we might find 1 Chinese, 1 Arab, and 5 from other places in the world. Does that change how you feel about that room? Does it make it any different? If we said that that room, we decided to play with the kind of standard gender split and kind of moved that rather than from 50-50 in terms of men and women, that we had a room full of men, does that make a difference to how you feel in that room? If it was a room full of women, 100 women in one room, and you're perhaps the solitary male, how would you feel in that kind of... I'm not making any comment. You're laughing at whatever you want to laugh at there. How does it feel in that kind of room? Who do you talk to in that kind of room? How do you feel about the people in that place? If the room was full of academics, how does that change how you feel about that room? If the room was full of millionaires, how does that change how you feel about talking around the room? If it was full of homeless people, how does that change how you feel about the room? If it was full of prisoners, how does that change how you would feel in that room? If the room were full of prostitutes, how would that feel? I think the honest answer for most of us, the painful answer in perhaps some cases, is that depending on the room, we might experience a whole range of feelings, from touches of superiority. I think that's a confession that we would probably need to make, that we might feel subordinate to some of those peoples, again, people in unhealthy ways. We might feel sympathy, pity even. We might feel fear, anxiety, many other things besides, because we're a mess of cultural conditioning, aren't we? We're a mess of experience. We come with all sorts of biases, some of which we're aware of, some of which we carry around with us. The reason I thought we might think about all of these things is perhaps what you would expect in terms of just asking you to think and feel about the kind of the main character in our story this morning, but it's as much about what this chapter in Joshua is trying to do for us by way of use of what we call biblical irony. I've talked about this previously here, I know that I have, but biblical irony is all about the expectations that we have in the scenario. It's even about cliche, and then using that bias to transform your thoughts and the story that's being told. What we don't see through our modern eyes when we read this story are a number of things that are probably clear to the more ancient listener. First of all, this story is absolutely jam-packed full of ancient innuendo. I didn't get that from Norman's reading. He didn't read it quite saucily enough, probably from the original text. I could have warned you about that, Norman, but I was just a little bit worried as to how far you would go. But absolutely, it is absolutely true that this story contains within it a number of setups for it being a bit saucy. I was so grateful to Honchi for not going too PG this morning. I thought you did a very good job of avoiding some of the things that were probably essential to avoid with our children present. But it's absolutely true that here is a story that sets us up, and it's a bit saucy, that the language that's used is absolutely a bit innuendo. There's a bit of double entendre. It's that kind of story that we receive at this point, to the point where even Rahab's name is one that we could probably translate to all sorts of things this morning. The way that I'd probably want to translate it, you know, if you're aware of the Bond films or the world of Bond, as we've already had mentioned this morning, you know that there are lots of female characters within the Bond world that have names that are absolutely dripping with innuendo. I'm not going to mention any of them this morning, because I feel like I'm on dodgy territory. But if you know any of those names, then it's kind of that kind of name, because the word Rahab comes from a root word which means open, and what we're probably talking about is Rahab being somebody who is open, and again, you can interpret that in whatever way you will. If whatever you're probably thinking now is what it probably means, but it is a saucy name in itself. This is somebody who we as soon as we hear this name Rahab, we're set up to think, well, here is, I'm going to call her Madam Rahab at this point, because I think you kind of get the end. I think you know where I'm at here this morning. I don't know how I end up talking about these things. I'd love to know, but anyway, here we go. But that's the way that the text is set up, that we know exactly who this character Rahab is. Madam Rahab. She's the local harlot. That's one of my favorite words that's been used in some of the commentaries that I've been reading. But she is a prostitute. That is who she is. So Rahab being set up as this cliche madam with her earthly wiles, her sensual disposition, and the constant question then as to how these spies end up in her house. That is immediately a question that we are. Now, I have to say that there is no suggestion here whatsoever that the spies are doing something naughty. They haven't visited, we don't think, Rahab for the reasons that she has opened for business. There's no suggestion of that, but you've got this kind of juxtaposition, and I want to just go into that a little bit before we go along, before we dig deeper. We've left Joshua after a compilation of speeches. That's what happens in Joshua chapter 1, and we looked at the way that God speaks last week, that you're using an encouragement, a mission, and an assurance, if you remember that little pattern that I brought to you last week. But this is very much about the beginning of the story now. This is about us. We've left Moses behind a little bit, and it's very much asking the question about whether you're able to stand still or let God do the next bit and trust him for it, or whether you've got to step out and look to the horizon and see what lies ahead. I think that's a common conundrum for us, isn't it? It's about how we act when we know that God has spoken. Is it that we just stand still and wait for God to introduce us to the next bit? Or actually, do we need to reach out in some way and test whether that next step is true? I think that's a real challenge for us as people. We might know that God exists. We might know him to be true. We might even feel like he has called or asked us to do something according to his purposes. But how do we respond to that? Do we just stand still and wait for the next bit, or do we actually need to take a risk, take a step, move forwards in his presence? I think it's probably that latter example. I think a lot of the time that God will ask us then to say, right, I've called you to do this, you know what to do next. I think is what God often says to us. That actually the most obvious step is usually the most obvious step, that we need to do it in order to step into his purposes. But I think that's the challenge for God's people at this point. And I think that's why Joshua decides to send these spies out into the land. Bear in mind that spies have already been sent out to the land previously, because Joshua and Caleb were one of them. They were the only group that came back. They were the ones that reported that it was time to go across into the promised land. So what's Joshua doing? Well, he's working out what his first step is. He's trying to understand that he knows that Jericho's going to come into his path at some point. He doesn't necessarily know what's going to happen with Jericho, but he knows that Jericho's going to be there. And he needs to know. He needs some kind of assurance, a word of confidence, perhaps, to know that this is the step that God is calling him to do next. And so he sends these spies across the boundary, across the river, to see what's going on then at Jericho. We'll come to that in the near future. So then what we then expect from this story is this heroic tale of how these spies cross over into the promised land, and about how they return with this great story of triumph and espionage and perhaps even an intricate deception for the sake of the Lord, though we kind of already have that because Joshua was once that spy. But what we get instead of this kind of heroic tale of these spies going across into the land is this tale of these, I think, you know, and you're free to interpret how you want, I think of these relatively bungling spies. Because they cross over into this land, and what do we find out immediately? These are spies, and we're told that what seems like within minutes, that the local authorities know exactly where they are. I suggest to you, therefore, that they are probably a little bit incompetent. I wonder whether perhaps that we don't have their names because their images have been protected by the writers of this story, the compilers of this story. And then we're put into this position of these spies being found in the home of this Madam Rahab in a brothel. That's the story that we've got. So whereas we should have these heroic two men sent out as spies, a story of espionage and intrigue and all of those things, we're immediately turned ourselves over and above because the spies are incompetent, and Rahab immediately steps up as the heroic figure. She's the one who's got some common sense in this. She seems to have a grip of the situation in such a way that the spies absolutely don't. At this point, we're being completely set up. And again, it's this biblical irony that we've begun to imagine who this Madam Rahab is. We've associated with her all of these different things. And then we would immediately in our minds associate all these wonderful heroic acts with these spies. And yet the tables have been completely turned over. So we've got this rather delicious story for the readers of these bungling spies up on the roof covered in flax, of our heroes in a pickle, and a presumption in terms of this woman of what we must assume must be loose morality, but immediately finding that she's the one who does the right thing in the story, protecting them. What we also get, though, then, is this fascinating midsection. The storytelling is brilliant in what we've now got, in that we've got now to the initial rescue, but we're left with this dilemma now that the city gates are closed. The net's kind of drawing in around these spies. They're trapped and at the mercy of this questionable Rahab. We've got to the question of why she's done what she's done. Because it doesn't make sense, actually. It actually seems impossible that she could become the heroine in the story, and yet look at what comes next. What we receive is this wonderful confession from Rahab. We wonder at how eloquent and yet convinced that she is. On one level, it's the practical talk of the woman who wants to save herself and her family. This is a pragmatic speech that says, I can see what's coming here. I've got to grips with the kind of political dimension of this, and I know what's going to keep me and my family safe. And on one level, that could be true, that this is just about her saving her skin and her perhaps even her livelihood, but definitely her family within those kind of things. She's pleading for her safety. But actually what we read is something that's more like the testimony of a new believer. That she knows exactly who God is, that she's able to give testimony, that she knows and understands the story of the Exodus. She knows that Moses brought God's people out into the Promised Land. She has known and understood that for what it is. She's heard about these battles, about God winning, about God going forwards, about God having something about him that means, well, there's power here. There's something here to be understood. She uses this language very much as a testimony. She understands the supernatural work of God parting the Red Sea. She recognizes the authority, perhaps even the presence of God upon earth and in the heavens. And for me, perhaps the most important thing then is the language that she uses in verse 12, where she talks about the kindness she has shown herself and the kindness she wants in return. Because this isn't about generic kindness. I introduced you to a word, I think probably a year or two now. Do you remember the word hesed? It's a word that I've used here before, and it's a word that means God's loving kindness. But that word hesed in the Hebrew, which is a Hebrew word, is about God's loving kindness according to his covenant. It's the language of a Hebrew people, of the Israelites, of God's people. That's a word that belongs to God's people. And yet the word that she uses, this Rahab, this woman of loose morality, is that word hesed. That somehow she has understood what God's loving kindness is. She's invoking in these people. Somehow she has learnt this language of Yahweh, the covenant God of his people. It's a word that only belongs to people that understand that they are his treasured possession. How does that happen? We don't know what the story is. We don't know exactly what she's got to grips with. But what we do know is that she understands. So this absolutely moves from the simple words of somebody being pragmatic who understands the thing that's going to help her, the thing that's going to keep her safe. But actually it moves actually much more to the language of relationship. That she has understood the change that needs to, she has understood what God is doing out in the world and that she's a part of it. That she can be a part of that. And yet still in the story, in story terms, we're left with this incredible tension. Although she's telling this word of testimony that actually we can begin to believe her because of the words that are present in her testimony. How do we know that this isn't a front? You know, maybe she's just learned the words. Maybe she's, persuaded somebody of all that she will have seen all sorts of different people in terms of her trade. She will have got to know lots of different people. What if this is all just a front? What if she's able to use these words but doesn't mean them? We're being set up in that way. I don't know if you remember the story from Judges. You may not. It's a little story, but the story of Shibboleth. Do you remember the story of Shibboleth? Where God's people are asked to speak this word. And if you're somebody that's part of the covenant, you would know how to say Shibboleth. And if you're not, you would only be able to say Sibboleth. Yeah? That's the story. It's in Judges 12. You can read it in your own time and do what you want with that. But it reminded me very much of that. It's a word that was kind of used like a password. If you know this word and you can say it as Shibboleth because you're a Hebrew person and you know that that's the right way to say it, you're in. And it's like at this point, she's, by using, I think this word has said, she's being able to say her Shibboleth. She's actually able to say, this isn't just a front, this is something. And how's it proven then? What happens at this story? We've been given this picture. We don't know exactly where her brothel is based. We know that these spies have stumbled into it, and then it's like this door opening up. And it's like this expression of freedom opening up because she has a window to the outside wall. This is like a cinematic view. Suddenly, after saying all of these things, we've been led to believe, or we're still not quite sure whether we believe it, and then we see this open window where these spies can exit. This is just wonderful storytelling. I always wish I could read scripture again for the first time and I could understand it in the terms that it's, because this is the story of just this opening up. There is this path to safety and security once again. That the spies will absolutely be safe. That Rahab, the woman who's been set up, that we're supposed to think all sorts of things about her, but actually she has both given testimony herself, this wonderful ironic story. We expect all sorts of things from her, and yet she's the heroine in this situation. And then we come to the story of the Crimson Cord. Now, I confess that people have read all sorts of different things into this Crimson Cord. The one which I'm most persuaded by is that somehow, as we read it, that we're supposed to imagine it as something similar to the sign of the blood on the lintels in terms of the Passover. That for me is probably the most persuasive element of this, but I know plenty of other preachers, because I've seen some of them this week, that see the scarlet cord as a sign of Jesus' blood, and it's a sign of hope and redemption and freedom. I'm not saying it isn't those things. I'm just saying that I think people can go too far. It's just a red rope. But it could very much be about invoking that sign. It's like the Passover sign, that this is what will keep us safe. It's a sign of God's presence with them, like the blood of the lamb on the lintels. A sign of God's presence at the point of destruction, story of salvation, story of judgment, those kind of things. And yet, for all of this pondering about the story, and it really is a wonderfully told story, the point for me about this is perhaps even a theological one. And it's the reason why it's there at this point in the story, before the many stories of battle and victories and defeats and faithfulness and dishonor. And the point is this, that when God promises and when he's given assurances that he goes ahead of us and makes a way, and along the way he will show us that he's bigger than you have asked or seen or imagined, and that he will use the most unexpected people for his purposes. Beyond the realms of any possibility, he used Rahab, the character who's been set up for us as a cliche, but in reality is someone who we might better understand to be a victim, perhaps of economic poverty, probably someone trying to work out a family debt to the society. It's what most prostitutes are. That she's a woman who has caught the signs of God at work in the world and taken those signs and understood them for what they are, which is the breath of heaven and the coming of peace and grace and love. What Rahab understood was that though she needed to negotiate with the forces of human nature and bargain for her life, that before God she had received and understood his loving kindness, that chesed that we've mentioned, which is for those who God has adopted, for those who God has called. We know that line is somehow carried on through the good man who is Boaz. We're told in the genealogy at the beginning of Matthew's gospel that Rahab is the descendant of Boaz. Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, who again is this kind of set up for us as a Jesus-like figure, somebody who comes to save and to rescue. We know that her reputation is maintained then through James' gospel, who speaks of her faith and other places in scripture. Here was the story of faith from someone who it's least expected. And yet here is the story of God working in places where we don't expect. An example of God seeing treasure and humanity seeing rubbish. And it's with that in mind that we as his people must begin to pull down the barriers that we find when we enter that room. That the divides that we find in humanity simply do not hold. That more often God is at work in places that we do not expect. And that the greatest mystery and miracle is that God looks at you. Though you may have become convinced that you yourself are rubbish, that lots of people may have thrown you out and put you aside in the way that rubbish deserves, though you've got a stigma because you're a bit broken and oppressed, by the things that you've done. Even in you, God sees treasure. Even you. And if you can only begin to understand the chesed, the loving kindness of God, you will see that you might need polishing in places, but that his love will cover over the cracks. That God is at work in your future, even though he has seen your past. The only question remains is what you will do with it. What you will do with your present, and what you will report back to your tribe in the way that those spies did. I pray that God will show you today that what he has already seen in you. Because the point here is that God is already convinced by you. That he has already loved you. That he has already shown you grace upon grace. And the challenge for you is whether you're going to begin to believe it. And the only way you can do that is by asking. By inviting him into your current situation. By inviting him into your heart and mind. And expecting and understanding that God will speak. That's the confidence that I have, because it's what he did to me. And that God has seen my past. He has understood my future in a way that I can't understand. But I want him here in the present. So perhaps today you could ask him into your present and understand that there is a better future for you.